Again, we're looking at these 3 points that I was asked to speak on, 3 points in the primacy of the Gospel Committee report, dealing with the disagreements between that committee and the 18 study committee. And those three were application of Ellen White's remarks in regard to 1880 history, Ellen White's endorsements of Jones and Wagner and how they're applied, and historical accuracy, or rather historical inaccuracy. And rather than, again, coming and presenting these separate presentations and seeking to defend the 1880 study committee per se, I'm just looking at our history and saying, how have we done as a people all the way along on all three of these points? They're valid points that should, you know, we need to understand the endorsements of Ellen White, of A.T. Jones, and E.J. Wagner, and not misapply them. We need to be accurate with our history, and then we need to apply accurately Ellen White's comments in regard to 1888 and the principles that are still relevant today. And so I'm wanting to see how we have done that. Last night we looked at the first generation, that where this all began. And then just a little bit ago we finished, we looked at the second generation, which was the 1920s and on. And how did we do in these three areas? Again, there's kind of been two rivers of thought that have come out of this, and these rivers of thought continue to build on the previous generation. And my point is not so much to say that, you know, it's all one or the other, or all or none, but that we need to get back to to understanding the original history and apply it appropriately. Also mentioned the danger of what happens when extremes come in, and responding to an extreme sometimes brings about a reciprocal extreme, and that pendulum seems to swing back and forth. So now we're going to look at the third generation. We're going to see probably some of the same things. And how can we learn from this? So, re-examining Minneapolis, 1888. And, of course, Robert Whelan and Donald Short are at the key movers here behind 1888, re-examined in the 1950s. And we're going to look a little bit about this history. And now, I have to tell you that this is some history that I learned just this last week. So, talk about never, you know, knowing it all. I can, this presentation will prove that. I've learned things I never knew before. I ran across on the Andrews University website of their an article of an interview Elder Whelan gave in the 1970s, telling the story of the history behind 1888 reexamined. No, he was interviewed by a student here at Andrews, and it's in a paper. Now, I was looking for images, pictures to put in my presentation, and I ran across this article. Never seen it before. So I'm not here, again, to defend 1888 Study Committee, Whelan or Short. I'm not suggesting they're infallible. That's not the issue. I wanted to look at the history of this and how this discussion of 1888 has continued on over the generations. So Whelan was born in 1916 into a Lutheran home. Now, these are all my comments. I'm just summarizing as I've read from this interview that he had. After his mother died when he was two, the family attended the Methodist and then Presbyterian Church. At 12, Whelan discovered the Sabbath truth, and soon thereafter, in 1929, he was baptized into the Seventh-day Adventist Church along with his father. After standing alone as the lone SDA in a Florida high school, Whelan attended Southern Junior College, now Southern Adventist University, and Washington. No, I'm sorry, SAU. What's SAU? Is okay. And Washington Missionary College, now WAU. While there in 1938, Whelan discovered the glad tidings and fell in love with the gospel that was presented there. So one of his teachers. Evidently, there was a copy in the library or something, and Whelan, or the teacher actually had a copy, and Whelan read some of that and was really blessed. Never heard of Wagner, obviously, before this time. He knew nothing of Wagner, 1888, Ellen White's endorsements of their message, none of that, even when he discovered this book. He copied on his typewriter large portions of Wagner's book, which was then out of print, and eventually took some of those copies of the pages he's typed with him when he went to Africa. Well, Whelan graduated in 1939, went to Florida as a literature evangelist for a year, then joined the conference evangelistic team. After a marriage to Grace in 1942, Whelan held his first pastorate. Short time later, he was called to be a mission director of the Uganda field in Southern Africa Division. A year and a half later, he was appointed as president of Uganda field. Now that's, to me, pretty amazing at a young age. Donald Short, whom Whelan had been acquainted with since high school days, was already in Kenya at the time. In 1947 and 48, Whelan was challenged by a false revival called the, and I don't even know how to pronounce this, but this is an African word, Abolokoli, which came from the Church of England, African churches, and swept into Uganda, even into the Adventist churches, into which many of the converts from the Church of England had come. Although initially there seemed to be a great revival of joy in the gospel, there was an emphasis on purely legal or forensic declaration only of justification by faith in this movement. Whelan went along with the revival for a short while, but was confronted by older pastors who pointed out the increasing immorality among the movement. And Whelan mentions this, and he says, so I can sympathize, or I can relate to those who, when a message comes, they don't always see all that's there. After some serious study and counsel with other missionaries, Whelan discovered the concepts of agape love in the cross of Christ and confronted the false revival by presenting the genuine message of righteousness by faith, paralleled with the concept of the cleansing of the sanctuary. And this is what he did when he tried to meet this false revival there in Africa. Soon after successfully meeting this challenge of a false evangelical revival in Africa, Whelan took furlough in 1949 and returned to America. And again, the key leader in this Abolokoli movement, the Adventist, when they were confronted, I guess, with Whelan along with some of the other older ministers, that person left and went back to the Church of England at this revival. Whelan took furlough in 1949, returned to America. Donald Short returned on the same passage, and they became more fully acquainted. While on layover in England, Whelan obtained, by providential happenings, a copy of the Glad Tidings for himself and reread the entire book on his voyage to the U.S. An interesting story. Rosa Spicer was an old lady in her 90s that happened to be there in England. He was there for 5 weeks before the ship came over to America. And an Adventist lady, and as Whelan talked to her, the conversation somehow turned to Wagner, and so he asked if she had ever heard of a book called The Glad Tidings, and she had, and she said, I used to have a copy. So Whelan said, well, could you see if you can find it? And she looked a couple times, finally found it, and Whelan, you know, looked at it again, and he told her, he said, you know, if you ever find that you don't have need for this, would you let me know? I'd love a copy. Because, of course, this is in the days when there wasn't copy machines, and she said yes, and then she took the book back, and to his disappointment, put it on her shelf. And 2 days later, though, she came down the hall wherever they were staying, and she gave it to him, and she said, you know, I'm not going to be on this earth much longer. I have a feeling that you're going to need this book, mm-hmm. and gave it to him. And so that was, again, his reintroduction to Wagner and the Glad Tidings. Read it on the way over. So this is Washington Missionary College there, Tacoma, at the time, where General Conference headquarters, I believe, was still at the time. And Whelan, upon arriving, he left his wife in Tennessee, and he went to enroll in the seminary along with Donald Short. So upon arrival in the U.S., Whelan and Short enrolled in the Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C., and began classes. Whelan was particularly excited to be taking a special class then offered on righteousness by faith. So they actually had a class on righteousness by faith that fall in the seminary, and so he took that. The teacher referred to the students to the 1888 conference and to the literature then available on the topic. Christian Spaulding's and Peace's work was referred to or recommended to read, along with the 1893 General Conference Bulletin. For the first time, now get this, I didn't realize this, for the first time, Whelan was introduced to the fact that there was a special message sent to the church in 1888. He had never heard of 1888, he says in this interview, even though he had read Wagner's book. He knew there was no, he had no connection, no understanding that there was an 1888. But he discovered, which he discovered from reading the 1893 Bulletin articles, which was the beginning of the latter rain, what he read there, and coincided with the message of Wagner that he had just read on the ship, you know, over to America. Whelan's heart thrilled as he was personally studying the 188 message of righteousness by faith, which he says to him even then realized was not just a reemphasis of 16th century Reformation gospel. However, he began to sense in the lessons from the class he was taking that they were promoting an evangelical concept of righteousness by faith, which seemingly spiritualistic concepts similar to the false Abel Kohli revival he had dealt with in Africa. So this is how, this is what, this is the history behind this, the whole movement of, or the whole, his whole interest in 1888.
Do you know who the teacher was?
I do.
Who was it?
I'll tell you in a little bit. I'm afraid if I tell you now, you won't listen to the rest of what I have to say. Remember what you write, so you know. And he began to see a contrast. Now get this, a contrast between two gospels was exemplified in his mind by his personal study. So on the side, he's reading the 1893 Bulletin, just read Wagner's Glad Tidings, and the lessons that he's studying for the class. Whelan soon discovered that much of the material, concepts, and even illustrations, specific illustrations, in the Righteousness by Faith class were taken from E. Stanley Jones' work. So, again, I feel, now, out of all these three presentations, I feel like I'm walking on the eggshells here the most because I'm not an expert on any of this, but E. Stanley Jones. Well, who's E. Stanley Jones? He was a 20th century Methodist Christian missionary and theologian. He is remembered chiefly for his interreligious lectures to the educated classes in India. He spent much time with Gandhi and the Nehru family. Gandhi challenged E. Stanley Jones, and through Jones' writing, the thousands of Western missionaries working there, to include greater respect for the mindset and strengths of the Indian culture and religion in their work. This is from Wikipedia, by the way. I don't know if that's a good place to go, but anyways, this effort to contextualize Christianity for India was the subject of his seminal work, The Christ of the Indian Road, which sold more than 1 million copies worldwide after the publication in 1925. He wrote 30 books, and The Way to Power and Poise was published in 1949. Now, he was also instrumental in starting what was called United Christian Ashrams. And the definition of ashram, if you don't know, which I did not, is a place where a person or a group of people go to live separately from the rest of society and practice the Hindu religion.
Monastery.
Like a monastery, yeah. The residents of an ashram regularly perform spiritual and physical exercises such as the various forms of yoga. Other sacrifices and penances were also performed. That's again a quote. So E. Stanley Jones was sorry, I have to look and see what okay, so by the way, ashram, the whole idea of this kind of trying to meet Hinduism by joining in somewhat with their practices was started in 19th century by a Jesuit in a ecumenical movement even earlier than E. Stanley Jones. Now, this is, I'm sorry, I don't see my reference here, so this is again from Wikipedia. His work, E. Stanley Jones, became interdenominational and worldwide. He helped to reestablish the Indian ashram, or forest retreat, as a means of drawing men and women together for days at a time to study in depth their own spiritual natures and quests, and what the different faiths offered individuals. In 1930, along with a British missionary and Indian pastor, and using the sound Christian missionary principles of indigenization, and then it defines the indigenization, God's reconciliation to mankind through Jesus Christ on the cross, He made him visible as the universal Son of Man who had come for all people. This opening up of nations to receiving Christ within their own framework marked a new approach in missions called indigenization. In other words, so it's kind of this blending of going to meet people, but not, you know, seeing that kind of merging Christianity with Indian Hindu practices. Dr. Jones reconstituted the ashram with Christian disciplines. This institution became known as the Christian Ashram. Our call, they say, this is from E. Stanley Jones himself, and this is in a article, The Message of Satel Ashram. Our call, they say, is to share with non-Christian faiths, and this sharing means not only giving out what one has to non-Christians, but sharing what they have in their own faith. It means that Christ himself has deficiencies which are to be supplied by other faiths. So this
is that actually Jones, or is that yes. Spicer quoting?
Spicer's is quoting. Well, he's actually, you see the double quote there at the beginning and at the end. He's actually quoting E. Stanley Jones. Okay. So I'll get more to Spicer here. So, in other words, Wieland was faced in this class. He's reading on Righteousness by Faith. He's reading. Red Wagner, he's reading Jones, 1893 sermons, never heard of 1888. And so his heart is warmed by these things that he's reading. But in the class, there are things that are being taught and shared from E. Stanley Jones. And he's concerned. Well, in December of 1949, Wieland was called into D.E. Reebok, which that picture was of. He was the president of the seminary, to clear up an issue over his registration. He hadn't finished up his paperwork. He decided to share some of his concerns over what was being taught in the class on righteousness by faith. And this is a quote from his phone interview with, and the man's name, by the way, the student, was Bradley Roy Williams, that he did this phone interview with for this student's class. So Wieland says, is it? Okay. I communicated with him quite frankly, Wieland says, my concerns that the so-called righteousness by faith that was being taught there in the seminary was not what the Lord had sent the Seventh-day Adventist Church in the 1888 message. Now, this is based on what he read from Wagner, and he's been reading maybe for 2 months on this subject he's never heard of before. That this was rather a concept borrowed from the popular churches, not the real thing that the Lord wants Adventists to understand. And of course, I was full of enthusiasm. I saw its importance and communicated that to Elder Reebok, and I'm sure I was very outspoken in my declaration that what was being taught by our workers there in the seminary was not that message. Well, his reaction was negative, very, very decidedly so. And right quickly, he made up his mind that I should leave the seminary. And so Dr. Reebok actually took Elder Wieland down to his apartment and helped him check out all of his things, and he was expelled from the seminary. Well, before Wieland left the seminary, he finished reading the 1891 bulletin. This was, I think it was sometime in November, and so... he had nowhere else to go. I don't know if he couldn't remember if he stayed somewhere. I don't know if he stayed with someone else or rented a motel or something, but he decided to finish reading the 1893 bulletin, typing many pages on his portable typewriter. Quote, the more I read, the more I copied, and the more thrilled I was with the truth of this history, that really the 1888 message was not accepted. If it had been, we'd be in the kingdom by now. And that was his conclusion just at that point. This leaped at me from the pages of this 1893 bulletin. And by the way, I think that's because that's what Jones was saying, and Prescott, and others at the 1893 session itself. Now, continuing, Wieland quoting, now this was not generally known or recognized, and as I read Spalding and Christian, and I would suggest Peace as well, because he mentioned that earlier, I found that they had, an entirely different view of the significance of the 1880 history. To them, the message had been accepted, at least in the end, and all was pretty well, and blessings of the message were with us. So again, already, Wieland is reaping, or he's trying to now decipher which river is true. That's come from now the second generation. That's what he's facing. Well, the White Estates had been moved to Tacoma Park there. And as Wieland realized, there was such a contrast between what he was really reading in the 1893 bulletins and what he was hearing more of an evangelical message of righteousness by faith in the seminary class that he'd been expelled from. He thought, why don't I find out what Ellen White had to say? The White Estate is there. And so Wieland went down to the White Estate, and he was told that the Ellen White material on 1888 was, and he asked for it. He said, I would like to read anything about 1888. And the person that was there said, well, that's a sensitive subject, and we don't generally allow people access to that. And the person, by the way, was D.E. Robinson. And so he asked Wieland, well, why do you want to see it? And Wieland said, well, I was in the class, and there's a discrepancy, and I want to know what Ellen White said. And so Robinson said, well, you know, who are you? And he said, well, president from Uganda conference or mission, and I know your son. And I can't remember D.E. Robinson's son's name, but another Robinson who was in Africa, and he worked with him. And so that combination seemed to get him access to the 1888 file.
Providence.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So he was handed the file, a file in 1888. He even recalls in his phone interview that it was file 189, which I think is correct, a file in 1888. And he read that. He asked, can I type what I'm, and D.E. Robinson allowed him to do that. So he did that, and 5 o'clock came, and the office closed, so he said, can I come back tomorrow? Sure, and so he went back to wherever he was staying, came back the next day, and D.E. Robinson said, sorry, I made a mistake, I can't let you have that file. Now you can imagine the feeling of someone who's reading something of great interest being turned away from that. It's like a fire burning in your bones. So after being heading out of Tacoma Park back, after he leaves the office that morning, actually D.E. Robinson handed him, he said, I'll give you something else. So he handed him the manuscript for Testimonies to Ministers. Well, Elder Wieland said, you know, that's not what I'm wanting to look at. So he left the White Estate, and this is what he says. As I walked out to the hall, into the sunshine that December morning, I was determined in my heart that if God would help me, I would get to the bottom of this. I couldn't finish that file. Why this reticence? Why the desire to cover up this tremendous history of the beginning of the latter rain, the outpouring of the Holy Spirit that was to finish God's work in all the earth? And he got that from reading the 1893 bulletin. Why must this evidence be covered up? I just couldn't understand it. Here's what Ellen White called a most precious message, and the White Estate was maintaining secrecy about it, seemed to him. Covering up what Ellen White had to say about it, it was obvious that what Ellen White said was in complete contradiction of what Spalding and Christian and our textbook had been saying about it.
What are you quoting, by the way,
from Wieland? I am quoting from...
interview that Brad Williams had with.
It's an interview with Brad Williams that you guys have here at Andrews University.
Is
so
it a term paper? Is it in the student movement or what?
It was a term paper for a class, and it's electronic. It's digitalized now, and you can get it online. So let me. It's called. The name of the paper is Wieland Pre-1950 is the name of it. Or Robert J. Wieland Before 1888 Reexamined and Some of His Effects on Adventists. A report presented in partial fulfillment of the requirements of the course CHIS 574, Development of Seventh-day Adventist Theology, Andrews University, autumn 1978. So this is a part of that paper. It's a yeah. So it's a.
Who was the writer?
Bradley Williams. So Wieland, by the way, left the seminary in December, and that for the next several months he traveled around on the way to Tennessee, back to Florida, and he contacted as many of the retired ministers or elderly ministers that would have known Ellen White, and he asked if they had any material that Ellen White had wrote about 1888. So you understand any private collection. So he has this drive to continue studying into the subject. Now again, I'm not here to defend Wieland and Short other than to say this is their history and this is why they wrote 1888 Reexamined. I can personally say, however, that I would probably not be a Seventh-day Adventist today if it was not for 1888 Reexamined.
Amen.
And that book, to me, I'll tell you why. It was the history that told me the truth about God. I had so many questions about this God that was holding back that I didn't even know I had. And even though I didn't understand all the history when I first read it as a rebellious returning Adventist, I said, at least I know God's not to blame. So that's what history did to me. And so I thank Wieland and Short, with all their shortcomings, whatever they might be. They have flaws like all the rest of us, yes. But I want us to understand what drove him to write 1888 Reexamined. We're going to see that. And the idea was that within a few months, just in less than a year, he learned about 1888 and he wrote 1888 Reexamined in less than a year's time. His introduction and his writing of that book happened in less than a year's time. Well, February...
Well, he was young.
33 years old.
And investigated.
Yeah. February 1950, so this is just 2 months or 3 months after Wieland's been kicked out of the seminary, there is an article in Ministry Magazine called a book review published in Ministry Magazine on E. Stanley Jones' book, The Way to Power and Poise, published in 1949. Recommending the book to all Seventh-day Adventists. The reviewer was a popular evangelist at the time and the same teacher of the class over which Wieland had been expelled from in the seminary, George Vandeman.
George.
So see, again, the point you made earlier, here's the problem. If we accept everything a person says because of who they are, or throw out everything they say because of who they are, or are not willing to be concerned about what they're teaching because of who they are, all of these are the results if we look to the person and rather than the subject being taught. Okay. So this is what he said in this article in the Ministry Magazine. We believe that every Seventh-day Adventist worker who comes to the human problems and deals daily with men and women will find in this little volume a safe balance in the help given by the mental sciences and the saving provisions of fundamental Christianity. Perhaps the most helpful of these daily reading volumes written by this man, E. Stanley Jones, was his first, written in 1936, entitled Victorious Living. The simplicity in which he illustrates the great truths of righteousness by faith have not been repeated in any of these other volumes. So this is where George Vandeman was getting his lessons that he was teaching in his seminary class, for which Wieland saw a great contrast between what is there and what he's reading in Ellen White and 1893 bulletins, and that's what he told the seminary president, and he was expelled. Well, is Wieland the only one concerned about this? Well, an article... In April 1950, the Review and Herald ran an editorial article titled The Spreading Cloud of Mysticism by W.A. Spicer, former General Conference President from 1922 until 1930. April 6.
The title's the top.
Mullins on the front of the review, but this is the actual editorial on the next page.
The review is just, that's what the front of the review looks like. This is the second page, this is like page 5, April 6, 1950. So this is like, a month and a half later, Spicer writes this article on the spreading cloud of mysticism. There's W.A. Spicer. And this is what he says.
He understands the Indian.
48, yes, he had, by the way, had worked in India, okay? 48 years ago, our denomination was guarding the faith from peril of spreading religious mysticism. So he's referring to 1902.
Kellogg.
It was in books and papers and pulpits, floating in everywhere like a cloud of poisonous gas. It was a mixture of Western science. Remember what Vandeman had just said in his paper? Science. Falsely so-called, as Paul wrote of science of his day, and Eastern mysticism. It might be asked, what peril could such a movement be to people having the Advent message? But the author of error knows well how to label his wares. These things were offered us as a higher view of the third angel's message. The gift of the spirit of prophecy that helped us then forewarned us that the same errors would attack us again and again. All who see the trends in the world today know that the ideas of mysticism are all abroad in our time. Only recently I have been surprised to see how these ideas get into books and promotions where it would seem they have no logical place. It is as though some mastermind is moving everything to bring in final deception, the final deceptions. We dare not go to sleep to these things now.
Amen.
And I tell you, you got to read this whole article. For instance, only a few days ago I received a book sent free by a religious group working for international peace. Once this peace was to be fostered through the churches, now it is to be through religion. Apparently, it means to suggest a commingling of all religions, a commingling of all religions, a merging of different faiths. And then he quotes several quotes from the book. You want to guess whose book it is? E. Stanley Jones. The poise, taken from the title of one of his books, he speaks of is translated mind poise by some translators into English of the ancient scripture of Hinduism. Poise has been a slogan in Eastern philosophy these 2,000 years or more. I have avoided giving names of people and of books, so he didn't even name E. Stanley Jones or his book, not wishing to lead anyone to handle these things unless necessary. To handle it in mere curiosity may be like picking up an innocent-looking live wire. It is charged with power. The Lord told his people, Israel, that they were not to go so much as to inquire how the heathen round about them worshiped their gods.
Oh my.
But they were continually led astray by the very names and ornaments of the evil way. The fact is, we need the special protection of God from these things all abroad today. The truths of the Advent message are our defenses. W.A. Spicer. Well, Wieland was curious. Was he responding to that ministry editorial book review? And so he wrote to Spicer. And this is Wieland speaking here. Elder Spicer replied immediately and said, yes, that's exactly what he was referenced to, that he regarded E. Stanley Jones as doing about the worst work of any modern religious agent. He felt deeply concerned for our people who were being confused by it, and was so happy that I had discerned the evil in that book. And by the way, I forgot to mention, when Wieland wrote to Spicer, he told him his experience in the seminary, how he'd been kicked out, how he was studying into these things, and how then he'd seen this book review in the ministry, and he'd actually written to the ministry and with his concern, and the reply was, cease and desist. He wrote to the General Conference about it. The president thanked him for the letter, but there was no follow-up or response. But W.A. Spicer was so happy that he had discerned the evil in the book and had protested to the General Conference that I had. He added that if others would protest as I had done, it might do some good. I wrote back immediately and said to Elder Spicer, why don't you protest? I'm nobody. I can't say anything. Nobody will listen to me, but you're somebody and they'll listen to you. Well, Spicer wrote back and said, well, General Conference is coming up. People are too busy planning for that, but I'll do that. And The summer, November, in November review, after the general conference, Spicer wrote a much more detailed article on this whole thing. And I'll see, I think I have it coming up here. Well, what about E. Stanley Jones? And I'm going to take a little rabbit trail here, if you don't mind. What about E. Stanley Jones today? How far is his influence? Is it still around? Well, there's a E. Stanley Jones Foundation is an organization or a foundation that still promotes E. Stanley Jones ideas and his idea of indigenization, way to approach and reach other people of other faiths to actually bring in their concepts and so forth.
He should have created the coexist bumper sticker.
Maybe, yes. So these are places where E. Stanley Jones, what would I say? E. Stanley Jones chairs. So in other words, these are actual people that are chairs. I'm not a university person, but evidently they represent then this foundation, a department. Yeah.
Do you see any connection with the emerging church?
Don't get ahead of me, would you please? Okay. Duke Divinity School, Africa University, Russian United Methodist, Methodist Theology School, Ohio, Wesley Theological, Boston University, Drew University, Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary, Southern Methodist, Candler School of Theology are the places where these chairs, where there are professors who are E. Stanley Jones Foundation chairs or whatever in their
department. In other words, the foundation makes an endowment that pays the salary for that professor.
Right. Okay, thank you. So E. Stanley Jones, and this is from this E. Stanley Jones website, professors of evangelism prepare students for ministry in local churches. Most of the teaching occurs in Master Divinity degree programs with an emphasis of growing congregations, so church growth. Additionally, several institutions provide education at the doctoral level under the leadership of E. Stanley Jones, professors of evangelism. Their impact is far-reaching. So this is very real today. Now, when I was when I was doing this study on E. Stanley Jones this last week, I thought, well, I got to get a picture, you know, of E. Stanley Jones, and so I put a Google search images, and another picture kept popping up. So I went to, Leonard Tweet. So I went to his books, his website. I typed in Leonard Tweet, or E. Stanley Jones, Leonard Tweet. And one of the first hits was Leonard Tweet's website. So this is his personal website where he promotes his books. And this is what it says. Leonard Tweet is a scholar of USA American culture. This is on his website. A semiotician, and you have to go look that one up, I had to anyways, who sees things the rest of us do not see and dreams possibilities that are beyond most of our imagining, and a preacher and best-selling author who communicates the gospel with the signature bridging of the worlds of faith, academia, and popular culture. There's so much in between the lines there, it's amazing. But it's this idea of bridging between cultures and academia and so forth. Very next paragraph, currently the E. Stanley Jones Professor of Evangelism at Drew University, Madison, New Jersey, and a visiting distinguished professor of George Fox University,
Portland, Oregon.
Lynn was vice president and so forth. Well, it just so happens that four of the five leaders of the current movement among young people in our church today on almost every university campus, the four of the five initial leaders have graduated from George Fox University under Leonard Sweet, who's the distinguished E. Stanley Jones, you know. Now, here's the concern I have, and again, this is part of my rabbit trail, but there's been a couple of articles, one here in Spectrum, The One Project, Danger or Blessing, that are looking at The One Project as the 1888 message for today. And this is from an article by Charles Scriven, in Spectrum says, is it the second coming of 1888? Is it radical Christian centrism birthing a bold new prophetic Adventism? Is it spiritual snack food or feel-good Jesus doled out like cookies for the all-too-comfortable? Such questions invite the one activity that the one project seems bound to stimulate. So their ideas, you know, conversation, you know, this rhetoric. So now this is written by a pastor in Australia, a young pastor, who wrote this article, was posted on Spectrum, where he's asked the question, is it danger or blessing? And of course, the result, or his conclusion after it, is that, you know, any accusations or concern about the One Project are unfounded. I had no intention of, and this is what he says, I had no intention of attending the One Project. However, being familiar with those who argue that we stick to the old landmarks in 1888, we were not willing to embrace a position that would find us fighting against God. We must also remember as Adventists that this anti-Jesus only thought pattern, this suspicion of doctrine, disillusion in the name of Christ-centeredness, is exactly what took place during the 1888 crisis. In other words, if you oppose this movement, it's like the Butler and Smith, you know, thing, right? Those who opposed the message that Jones and Wagner were preaching did so partly because they felt that it was a threat to Adventist identity. It is from this crisis that the One Project appears to build some of its philosophy, and that's very true. I sensed this, or, you know, before he stated this, and because their presentation in Seattle, the first big one, they went over Adventist history, and I tell you, it was very skewed to the particular view. Many of his statements actually reflect the thought patterns of Ellen White's lifelong ministry, especially the ones she made following the 1888 crisis. My concern is that our young people, if they're not founded in our history, well, how are they going to accept this thing? Now, I have, this is a, I'll see if this even works. I have a 1 minute clip, sound bite here. This is 2010 in California. Four of the five speakers or leaders in this video are pastors. Okay, four of the five are pastors, Adventist pastors to youth. Three of the five are leaders in the One Project. Okay? Now, this is not at a One Project, but these are the same leaders the same year that they began this One Project. And I will... This is an Adventist church in California. Welcome to the Rock Show. Tim Gillespie was a singer. Sam Lenore from La Sierra, one of the guitar players. Roy Ice was the drum player, and they're all involved in the One Project. And the other pastor, I can't remember his name, is from Riverside, I believe. This was the Adventist church on a Saturday night. So my question is, I tell you, if this is the 1888 message leaders for this era, God help us. And again, I don't show that to, I'm just saying that's where we're at today. We've come around again. E. Stanley Jones is still here.
It's not going to go away.
And Wieland and Short in 1950 were basically faced in their day with, okay, we have a message that's from the past that I've never heard of before, that this church needs, and yet we're presenting thoughts from evangelicals as something that we need to present for all Adventists.
That's the genuine.
as if it's the genuine. So there's a decision. Well, McElhaney was General Conference President from 1936 to 1950. He was replaced in 1950 by Branson, so this was his final General Conference session there in San Francisco. Attending the General Conference session in San Francisco in early July 1950, both Whelan and Short once again shared a sense of concern as some of the spiritualistic-sounding concepts were shared in the, quote, Christ-centered preaching meetings held by the Ministerial Association. So even while they went to the 1950 General Conference in San Francisco, and they again sensed some of these same concepts are even being presented there at General Conference. Spurred on by J.L. McElhaney's exiting presidential address, so his final address to the church, McElhaney warned Adventists not to set aside or modify or compromise their foundational principles of truth. That was his exiting address, I guess. And by a public announcement that delegates share any concerns they might have. So there was actually, in somebody's presentation by one of the officers, GC officers, if you have concerns about the church, mm-hmm. submit your concerns. The two-pronged concern, so Whelan Short submitted a letter of concern to the members of the General Conference Committee. The two-pronged concern was this, that the message of 1888 had in fact never been fully accepted, wasn't accepted, and that another gospel was being imperceptibly promoted in its stead. So understand what generated this. It was being introduced to 1888, they never heard it before, and then confronted with what seemed to be the very thing they were facing in Africa, a spiritualistic mix of something. Whelan and Short's letter was submitted to the General Conference officers. Concerns over sending Whelan and Short back to Africa before clearing up their charges led to their call to a meeting with a small General Conference committee made up in part by A.V. Olson, Vice President, J.I. Robison, Associate Secretary, A.L. White, Associate Secretary of the White Estate, one Associate Secretary from Ministerial Association, and a few others. So they submitted, it was like a five-page letter, which you can still read in Al Hudson's book, A Warning and Its Reception, a copy of that. So they submitted this, and there was such initial concern. They were called into a meeting, they met in the meeting, and Whelan Shores got the idea, if we do not come up with a full explanation of our concern, we might lose our credentials. And I can understand that after what had happened to that point. No official action was taken following the meeting, but sensing, like I just said, over the next 6 weeks, they produced 1888 Reexamined. A private manuscript, 204 legal-sized pages, with over 500 Ellen White exhibits, most of which they had collected over the previous few months, voicing their convictions to the leadership of the church. And by the way, interesting to note, this is just something of interest, the original 1888 Reexamined does not have Whelan's 10 points of the 1888 message.
Right.
That was not something that he focused on in that. That didn't come until the 87. The other thing is that the last 100 pages of 1888 Reexamined, the last like three chapters was 100 pages. That is greatly reduced in the 87 revision. I honestly think that the last three chapters in here are as relevant, if not more, today, because they deal with the true and the false Christ, which was his issue, his concern. We're presenting a false Christ with this E. Stanley Jones evangelical mix.
Can I put a footnote to this?
Yes.
when we discussed republishing the 1880 Reexamined, or publishing the first time, I made a statement then. I said, I believe we ought to reproduce Warning and Reception.
Mm-hmm.
And it was turned down, by our board. And I thought maybe it was a good idea that we went this way. And for this reason, the other one was choppy,
mm-hmm.
and this one is much easier.
The new one.
The new one.
Yeah. Okay.
But my argument was for historical resources. That was I said this. Mm-hmm. If we should publish this, so if anyone wants to study it, they'll get some resources they'll not get in re-examines.
Yeah.
But I still think re-examines was a good move to
sure.
for the general population.
Right.
But I think that one's still good.
There's still, yeah, there's a lot in there. The reason I had never seen it, I started looking in there, and Wieland quotes quite a bit from, you know, other writers that were non-Adventists that were having the same concern of this false and true Christ that was coming into Christianity. So,
could you comment as to whether on the audio, so people can pick that up, whether this is available in digital form, the initial one?
The initial one available.
The warning and its reception is available on digital
form. Yes, it is. The warning and its reception is available on digital form. So,
where is
it? You tell me, Mr. Bischoff.
It's not on the Pioneer Library?
I'll give you a copy. Okay.
Yeah, send it to all of us.
Yeah, PDF. Okay, so again, these are just my summary points here. This is not a quote. The 1800 examined manuscript was submitted 6 weeks later and soon passed on by General Conference officers to the Defense Literature Committee, W.E. Reed, Frank Yost, and Froom, Lowell, White, Reebok, and Robison. The reason I mention names here, I'm not, again, there's not a lambasting, but I want us to see that
this
history. These are some of the same people then that are going to be dealing with other issues here that I'll show in just a moment.
And some of them already had made up their mind from previous
right,
encounters.
Exactly. And again, so, yes, you know, and that's the problem is that, you know, and then the devil, I tell you, is to blame, really, for all of this, you know. I mean, yes, fallible human beings, but
so
the devil knows this.
A non-seminary trained pastor going up against the George Veneman of the time.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And see, that's the danger with us today in worshiping men or throwing out men based on, yeah, yes.
What's the relationship of this George Bannerman and the founder of Buddhist Written?
Same.
Same
one?
Yeah.
Sure.
Oh, okay.
And see, that's the thing. I mean, when I first heard that, I didn't want to hear that, you know. I don't want to hear that. I don't know if he ever changed. I mean, maybe later he realized, you know, because, you know, we mistakes like that definitely can be made and hopefully repented of. 14 months later and long after Wieland and Short had been cleared to return to Africa. So the committee at least said, okay, you can at least go back to Africa. We know you're, you know, 1800 re-examined made very clear, you know, we have this concern, but we're, you know, we're loyal to the church. So they went back to Africa. It wasn't until 18 months, did I say 18? Months, 14 months later that a report was given in December of 1952. And basically the summary was a censuring of Wieland and Short for being critical of the church and misrepresenting Adventist history. Again, that accusation that we're looking at here. But the topic...
Could you address on the audio whether there was any evidence of a gag order on Wieland and Short?
There was. I mean, I think they basically said they didn't want them...
Go back to Africa, be quiet
about this.
Somebody asked them and they could say something else.
Yeah. Now, the topic didn't rest, though. One of the private copies that of 1800 were examined was leaked by a member of the Defense Literature Committee. So now this was the committee that it was submitted to.
It wasn't published.
It was not published.
It wasn't published.
And soon the mimeographed copies were making their way around the world, although against the wishes of Wieland and Short. And that I honestly believe that.
Yes.
They did not, this was not, they, I believe, were following a biblical counsel of, you know, going
right.
to the people. So, yes?
Probably the person that leaked it was not intending to publicize it.
Yeah, probably not. You know how that is.
These were the days before the internet.
Yeah, this is before the internet, and there's still a leak problem, right? So, yeah, boy, I tell you, you be careful what you say, right, today. Copies of the manuscript created considerable discussion among some church members and leaders, and in September 1958, a second General Conference report was delivered to Wieland and Short, made available to the World Church, the response further appraisal prepared by L. White, A. V. Olson, and H. W. Lowe, upheld the earlier defense committee findings with added charges of misrepresentation of Ellen White's writing.
Which they wouldn't give them access to.
Right. And that, you know, that is something that is heartbreaking to me is, you know, when I read, you know, for Wieland's shortcomings, sure, but when you read Faith on Trial, I mean, to the response back and forth is just, it's astonishing to me.
Explain what Faith on Trial is. Yeah.
Faith on Trial would be Wieland and Short's correspondence, thank you, between he and White Estates and Froom primarily. And so the accusations that, you know, if you Whelan and Short just had all the evidence, then you would know the truth. Well, can we have the evidence? No. And I mean, this was really a terrible a trial. So and reading that helps me understand sometimes where they were coming from. Yes. Is it figure? Okay, thank you. So we better get rid of his picture. I had a terrible time trying to find pictures with, so I better write that down, or somebody better remind me so I can take that off here. I could not find pictures of several of these people, necessarily.
Did you see Adventist Heritage, the article on, is there a picture of Anu there?
There might be. I know, you know, there's, this was all, I put
there
this.
There was a lot of quotes from Anu, but I don't know if there was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just put this together last week, so. So anyways, while that was going on, so now I've just went through that history of 18 and re-examined. You understand, I mean, I know this is preaching to the choir, I guess, but that was the history behind 18 and re-examined. At the very same time this is going on, Unruh, not this person, was writing to Barnhouse. And that's interesting that how this came about. You probably remember this. Barnhouse had a radio program, and he was talking about righteousness by faith, and so Unruh wrote him a letter of appreciation, and of course that started an interchange because Barnhouse, of course, said, you know, well, Adventists don't believe in righteousness by faith. Well, so Unruh sent Barnhouse a copy of Steps to Christ. This will show him that we believe in righteousness by faith, right? Well, this is Barnhouse's response in an editorial or an article in Eternity Magazine. And one of, this is talking about, in one of his letters to Barnhouse, Unruh, and where am I taking this from? Oh, this is Douglas's report on it. So this is Douglas quoting Barnhouse. So the single quotes are Barnhouse, the double quotes are Douglas. In one of his letters to Barnhouse, Unruh enclosed Steps to Christ, affirming the evangelical character of Adventist doctrine. And Barnhouse fired back an Eternity article on how to read religious books, stating that Steps to Christ was false in all its parts, bearing the mark of a counterfeit from the first page. He also charged that Steps to Christ promoted universalism, half-truth, satanic error, so much emphasis on God's love to unregenerate men smacked as universalism. Unruh decided there was no point in continuing the correspondence. So the reason I point this out is Steps to Christ is pointed at as the primary evidence of the 1888 message beginning to spread even through the message of Ellen White. And I say, yes, amen. And yet here's one of these two men that were involved in this evangelical dialogue who has put their stamp of condemnation on that very book. My question is, how can you merge theological concepts between, as Douglas says, you know, tectonic plates? How can they come together when they're so diverse? And how could we meet with them and come away with something good? This actually, it's actually his presentation at the symposium here. But actually, as I read through it, I realized I didn't have time to go back. This is exactly what he put in Fork in the Road. So you will find this quote in his book, Fork in the Road, which I believe either this document came out of Fork in the Road, or Fork in the Road was a result of this doc. I think it was after this, yeah. So yeah, Fork in the Road was probably just the publishing of this paper in a book form. So Walter Martin, of course, 1955. Again, this is at the very time the church is grappling with Whelan and Short's challenge. We had this message from the past. Have we ever fully accepted that? We're being faced with this new message of, you know, evangelical mix coming into the church. There's this dialogue going on with Barnhouse and Martin. Now, in 1955, it more officially started with Walter Martin. He was writing his book on the cult, as you all know, and he met with Walter Reed, Field Secretary Roy Allen Anderson, and L.E. Froom, Now, these were some of the same men again who were sitting on the committees dealing with 1888 reexamined. So, again, here's the point. You have men judging or looking at 1888 reexamined and corresponding and dialoguing with evangelicals. The church is faced, I feel, with this decision. Walter Martin's, now, here's the, I have about 20 slides, by the way. This is a little shorter presentation. So, Walter Martin's questions covered a wide range of Adventist theology, but four areas stuck out in Martin's mind: that the atonement of Christ was not completed upon the cross, that salvation is a result of grace plus works of the law. This is what he's accusing Adventism. That the Lord Jesus Christ was a created being, not all eternity, from all eternity, and that he partook of man's sinful nature at the incarnation. Now, let me just interject here. I'm not suggesting that the church had perfect theology before 1950, but I would suggest that questions on doctrine, as you know, did not replace it with something better. You know what I'm saying? In other words, I know there was some challenges there. The Walter Martin's issue with Arianism, you know, was a point that from some of the founders. But some of these other points, the reason I bring this out is I just want to show how Walter Martin's concerns have filtered down to today. There are other concerns stemming from the evangelical fundamentalist dispensationalist orientation of Barnhouse and Martin that might not be obvious from the above discussion. Now, this is George Knight describing this. One was the issue of a modern prophet. Those who, with a dispensationalist background, have generally held that the gift of prophecy came to an end with the death of the last of the apostles. In fact, the fundamentalist definition of a cult often includes a claim to the gift of prophecy. With that in mind, it is little wonder that the fundamentalist held, and he's speaking of Walt Martin and Barnhouse, held Adventism to be suspect, or that the Adventists, for their part, had a desire to demonstrate that their doctrinal views were biblical and not based upon Ellen White's writing. Now, that's, of course, legitimate. But understand that Walter Martin had theological issues, four main ones that came out of there, but he also had an issue with Ellen White and the authority of Ellen White. And I would suggest that all of his concerns have played into Adventism, and I believe that pendulum has swung again. Now, let me go. Yes.
Just quickly, in the summer of '94, I met Walter Martin at Remark.
Yes.
Did you happen to meet
him? I was there at the time. Yeah.
He was singing the praises of Remark. I told him Remark probably wouldn't be there without the ministry that he conveyed.
Yeah. He came there, of course, for health issues, and he died, I don't remember what year he died. I actually thought he died in 89, but I may be wrong. His successor, I guess you say, or his he mentored a man by the name of Kenneth R. Sample that worked with him. And I just want to show this next slide. Kenneth R. Sample wrote a follow-up then to Walter Martin's assessment of Adventism in 1988, issue of Christian Research Journal. And of course, he's detailing all of the issues that Walter Martin and Barnhouse had challenged Adventism. Of course, he deals with Desmond Ford, and he talks about all these theological issues. But what's interesting to me is the front cover of the issue of this journal that prints his you find that interesting?
Yeah.
So, I always thought it was all these issues, you know, righteousness by faith, nature of Christ, you know, the sanctuary and all of this. And yet, the picture they used in the journal that prints his follow-up assessment of Adventism is a picture of the pulling down of this statue of Ellen White. So, I think there's implications there of what's happened.
Do you have a picture of him?
No. I should re-show his picture, shouldn't I?
He died in 89.
Okay.
Don't go too fast. I mean, very fascinating.
Yeah, okay, sorry. I'm going back. I couldn't remember.
One more bit.
This one?
Oh, I see.
Okay. Sorry, I finished this last night. This tells you how unprepared I was coming here. But anyways, so I don't even have notes. I don't know what I'm... So this is Desmond Ford. Okay? And so what I'm just showing here, this is all, not new knowledge, but I'm just showing how he connects these events. I don't think it's R.R. Figure. Administration of the church in the 1950s marked an era of increasing openness toward new ideas and approaches by Seventh-day Adventism. Walter Martin came to Tacoma Park, Washington, D.C. with his inquiries and found hospitality, cooperation, and comparatively frankness. As a result, Questions on Doctrine was published, undoubtedly the greatest forward step theologically in decades. For the first time in Adventist history, leaders repudiated the sinful nature of Christ's concept, the exclusive remnant church theology, sectarian bias against other Christian bodies, the ceremonial and cleanliness basis for abstaining from certain foods, literalistic extremes regarding the heavenly sanctuary, etc. With great emphasis, the book rejected the idea that Ellen White's writings had doctrinal authority and the Protestant position of the Bible only was strongly affirmed. The problem here, of course, is these things all mean different things to different people. When you talk about authority of Ellen White or, you know, well, we go to the Bible. The thing is that Desmond Ford went to the Bible and he found things that Ellen White, that didn't agree with Ellen White, but since he went to the Bible, then that's okay because the Bible's the authority. And
if this is Desmond Ford, you got to be real careful. He's a master of misrepresentation.
Yeah.
Yes.
So when you read this, don't assume that's what really the situation was. That's his spin. That's what he
yeah.
wants you to believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
He's a good personal friend of mine, but
yeah.
That's the truth about it.
I've heard that, and I've never met him, but I've heard that very thing. The center of the earthquake, this continuing, Desmond Ford, The Adventist Crisis of Spiritual Identity is the name of this book or article. The center of the earthquake, however, is a doctrinal one, the gospel in the sanctuary, that the Pauline righteousness by faith is the technical term for justification alone. So anyways, this is the issue he's saying. Came out of the discussion, justification only. Christ's human nature was spiritual like Adam before the fall, that believers have the verdict of the last judgment the moment they believe and for as long as they believe, and that the investigative judgment has no basis in Scripture nor the date 1844. These revelations have left many reeling and dazed while having the opposite impact on others who are worshiping in the same pews. Again, the two rivers still flowing. The new doctrinal convictions have also aroused interest in the New Testament teachings on church government, priesthood, and so forth. Well, how has this whole event been described by others? Well, of course, Paxton, Shaking of Adventism, here's how he describes this list of issues. Belief that both the destiny of the church and its preparation for the world of Christ's long-delayed second advent hinge upon a true conception of righteousness by faith. Demands the commitment of every effort to expose what is seen as serious confusion regarding this heart of the gospel. So you sense the sincere, we've got to change, our Adventism needs to change, and, you know, we've got the answers. Affirmation of the doctrine of original sin underlies each of the three primary challenges to traditional Adventist theology. Now, let me interject here that Walter Martin and Barnhouse may not have stated everything as such, but as time has gone on, it has distilled down to these four points, or three points, which are underlied by the idea of original sin. Now, of course, Calvinist predestination, Barnhouse and Martin, their theological understanding would be, you know, totally built on that idea. So affirmation of the doctrine of original sin underlies each of the three primary challenges to traditional Adventist theology: repudiation of perfectionism, denial of Christ's assumption of sinful flesh, and restriction of the doctrine of justification by faith to strictly forensic objective factors. So when Jerry presented Friday afternoon, when Wagner says that, you know, righteousness by faith makes a person righteous, they condemn that as Roman Catholic theology. So, again, Paxton here says, as we have already noted, Ford was explicit in his affirmation of the doctrine of original sin. He taught this consistently through the 1960s into 1970s. Ford also strongly repudiated perfectionism as being contrary to the gospel. Likewise, he maintained the Protestant view, forensic justification only, I would add. Yes. Actually, this is a rewriting of Reformation history, I believe. It's actually a rewriting of what Luther taught. The Protestant stance on the sinlessness of Christ's nature, thus it would not be far from the truth to say that already in the 1960s, Dr. Ford anticipated the clear Reformation stream, even calls it a stream, that was to emerge within Adventism in 1970s. Now, this is Kenneth Sample. I couldn't find a picture for him. Actually, there were pictures, but I was afraid. I didn't know for sure, so I might have ended up with another mistake there. The roots of evangelical Adventism can certainly be traced to the Adventist scholars who dialogued with Barnhouse and Martin. So again, I'm not making this up. You all know this. This is even what non-Adventists see. When questioned on doctrine, repudiated such commonly held traditional doctrines as the sinful nature of Christ, literalistic extremes of the heavenly sanctuary, and the writings of Ellen White as an infallible doctrinal authority. There were also a good number of American Adventist scholars who were sympathetic to the Brimsmead-Ford position. This is, again, Kenneth Sample. The major doctrinal issues which united this group were, and then he lists them. So again, here's the five issues he lists here. Righteousness by faith. This group accepted the Reformation understanding of righteousness by faith, according to which righteousness by faith includes justification only. So again, this is forensic only. The human nature of Christ. Jesus Christ possessed a sinless human nature. Though Christ certainly suffered the limitations of real man, by nature he was impeccable, incapable of sin. See, and this was Barnhouse and Martin's position all along. That's why they had a problem, was they believed Christ could not even... There wasn't even a possibility that he could sin. Jesus was primarily our substitute, not example. Number three, the events of 1844. Jesus Christ entered into the most holy place, heaven itself, at his ascension. The sanctuary doctrine and investigative judgment have no basis in Scripture. This is what Kenneth Sample is saying. And assurance of salvation, our standing and assurance before God rests solely in Christ's imputed righteousness. Sinless perfection is not possible this side of heaven. So again, all of these kind of interlay so that any concept, you know, of a final cleansing of the sanctuary has no place in this understanding. There's no reason for it.
Well, can I mention that there's an interlink there? Because if you believe in forensic-only justification, and as Ford says, his mantra is, I go on sinning 1,000 times a day until Jesus comes.
Yeah.
For him to say that. If that's true, there can be no close of probation, end of the judgment,
right,
because everyone would be lost.
Right.
Therefore, there could be no beginning of the judgment, which is 1844. So
right.
Everything is interlinked.
Yes. And so that's what, when you read some of them, you have to read between the lines. That's because there's a lot more being said than what might appear at face value. And I would suggest that that's happening today in the movements today. Authority of Ellen White. Notice that he lists this, even though this is from that article. The front cover picture emphasizes number five more than it does any of the other issues. But it almost as if it seems that it's Ellen White that gets in the way of being able to remove these other four issues. And notice that's exactly how Seeking a Sanctuary. That was a poor picture. This is Lockhart and Malcolm Bull, 1982, Seeking a Sanctuary. A multitude of factors, they say, contributed to Ford's rejection of the sanctuary doctrine. A biblical scholar with a particular interest in the Book of Daniel, Ford found the traditional Adventist interpretation of certain crucial texts unsatisfactory. The influence, notice this, of Ellen White had been undermined by the historical research of the 1970s, I would say even before, Adventist forums and things that were going on even before, with the result that Ford himself, an Ellen White enthusiast, so we have someone that on the surface is an enthusiast, yet felt able to qualify the scope of her authority in the light of her error on the sanctuary question. And I tell you, once you start down this road, I'll tell you where it ends up. It's where Desmond Ford is today. Evolution, supportive of, Year-day principal out the window. I mean, the list goes on and on. So once you open that door, which is exactly what Ellen White said, it's that her writings led to the Bible, but if you throw away the spirit of prophecy, what would happen soon thereafter? I mean, it's the Bible. You throw the Bible out too. Now that, okay. Continuing on, Malcolm Bull and Keith Lockhart say, but the root of his attack on the doctrine was a conviction that the blotting out of the individual sin is no part of the salvation history. Ford took the implications, notice, of questions on doctrine to their logical conclusion. If the atonement was complete on the cross, then the sanctuary can only mediate its benefits to humans. If Christ did not have a fallen human nature, then there is no precedent for the perfection of humans. Thus, the benefits of the atonement mediated to men and women in the sanctuary service cannot be such as to bring them to perfection. If they are not brought to perfection, they are saved as sinners. If they are saved as sinners, their sins do not need to be individually eradicated. There are thus no supplementary benefits of the atonement that need to be mediated to humans, and the heavenly ministry of Christ becomes superfluous. The sequence of events...
It becomes as impotent as the blood of bulls and goats.
Right, exactly.
Which could not bring to perfection.
Right. The sequence of events that leads from questions on doctrine to the dismal dismissal of Desmond Ford is a remarkable example of the way in which a web of theological ideas can unravel once a single thread has been cut. So I think it's very insightful what is seen now. Now I would add here that, and I forgot to mention this earlier, you know, the response to question on doctrine sometimes, we talked about this pendulum, historic Adventism per se, I guess, I don't, you know, that sometimes the response has swung then the other direction so that there's a repulsion against. And what's interesting to me, in the 1990s, there was a time at which the 1880 Study Committee was being condemned by historic Adventisms as teaching universalism and cheap grace, mm-hmm. and being in the camp with, and literally, they literally would say this, you're in the camp with the George Knights and the Woodrow Riddens and the Roy Adams, while at the same time, those same authors were accusing, you know, the Whelan and Short and so forth of being in the camp with the historic Adventists because of the nature of Christ and perfectionism and things, you know, but so again, this pendulum, and I'm not advocating any of that in this, you know, we have to be so careful that when we try to right a wrong, we don't swing the other direction, and I know that's what Peter has been emphasizing, and it's such a valid point. The theology crisis, just a few more slides here to show how this has been perceived. Now, I don't know if you knew, but Leroy Moore probably the Lord used in a marvelous way, because if I understand correctly, his thesis that was submitted at, was it Palmdale or
Righteousness by Faith?
Yes. Helped, because so many people were being pulled in mm-hmm. by this. So I feel that Leroy Moore did, you know, was it, that God used that. Mm-hmm. To stop would have been much worse if he hadn't been there. So now notice what happened with this new view now, even in regards to the book A.G. Daniels wrote. With A.G. Daniels, Reformationist, meaning, you know, the Desmond Fords, Paxton, McMahon, Brinsmead group, contend that 188 message of righteousness by faith has never been accepted and identify it with the loud cry. So they would agree with that much. Significantly, though, Daniels is seen by Ford, Paxton, and Reformist not to have transmitted the light of righteousness by faith, but Jones-Wagner error, thus together with Andreasen introducing the omega of apostasy concerning which Ellen White warned. So we flip this 180 degrees now. So this is Leroy Moore again. Notice this. The primary Reformationist charge is that the doctrines of righteousness by faith has been confused in the ASDA Church by the denial of the doctrine of original sin. So again, we're going back to this summary of their concern, that the church is confused because of the denial of original sin. This, they hold, has given rise to three related heresies, that the gospel includes sanctification as well as justification. That's they consider a heresy. That Christ took the fallen nature of Adam, and a final generation must develop perfect characters before Christ's return. Now notice, this is the end of my introduction, by the way, for the last 3 days. Mm-hmm. This is the conclusion of this idea before. So let me read this. This is Leroy Moore again. Considering themselves to be the true proponents of righteousness by faith, Reformationists hold that Jones and Wagner, acknowledged 1888 exponents of the message, embedded four heresies in SDA doctrine. One, the rejection of the historic doctrine of original sin, inclusion of sanctification and righteousness by faith, claiming that Christ connected sinful flesh with his own sinless nature, and holding the doctrine of perfection. So now, who's to blame? Yeah. Ellen White's unusual endorsement of Jones and Wagner, whose earliest printed works reflect the above concepts, and I would just add here for clarification, as true and not heretical, requires overwhelming evidence to prove that she recognized their theological errors immediately after Minneapolis, reflecting Roman Catholic heresy. Because that's the charge, which I'll get to. Developments, Leroy Moore says, before, during, and after Minneapolis, deny such claims. This paragraph is so packed, you have to read it a couple times to get what he's saying. So here's the point that I'm really trying to make, and everything else I said builds up to this one point. How we today look at history, Ellen White's endorsements, and application of Ellen White's statements about 1888 all depends on the river that we are coming from of our history. So here we are, 100, at this time, almost 100 years after Minneapolis, and now Jones and Wagner are to blame for what is considered heresy today, which never was noticed until dialogue with evangelical scholars. Mm-hmm. How can that be? None of this came, all the early writers in the 1930s and 1940s never identified this as an error. It only developed, it only was stated as such after the 1950s and 60s. So I have a paper, but I couldn't print it this morning, that I was going to just hand out, but this, of course, is my words, and the result of this previous view that we just looked at, more here, of identifying Jones and Wagner as the cause of the whole problem, has led to these evaluations, and this is just a summary. The most precious message God sent in 1888 was the evangelical gospel, and for every one of these, I could give you a specific quote. Their 1888 message is termed evangelical gospel, which is combined with Adventist distinctives made up the three angels' message. So the idea is that we have the Sabbath and the state of the dead, and you just attach that to E. Stanley Jones, and you've got the three angels' message. That's not true. The 18 message is that which was given in 1888 only. And why?
Because we don't have a written account of that.
But we don't have we don't know exactly what they said. However, we know that the emphasis was on Christianity. So Ellen White, so it was just basic Christianity. Right. And so then, well, what about after 18? And it's actually the messages of 1888 only, not 1889, not 1893, not 1895. Why? Well, because after that, Ellen White supported the general Christianity message that Jones and Wagner presented in 1888, but clearly didn't agree with everything they said. Now, that is true, but then it is subjectively applied, her statements of, not everything Wagner says, lines up clearly. Well, we just attach that then to original sin. We attach that to, to whatever else we want to throw in there. Although she never indicated the areas, this is stated, although she never indicated all the areas she disagreed with Jones and Wagner in 1888, numerous examples can be found. And of course, then, they're readily found. Jones and Wagner had fatal flaws even before Minneapolis. This is seen by her many councils correcting them even before Minneapolis, but primarily after. This is why through, Return of the Lateran, I'm attempting to address every letter, every concern Ellen White had. that corrected Jones and Wagner and to put it in as objective a light as possible so that you see why she corrected them and why she didn't, and so that we don't misapply it to mean more than it meant. I'm not trying to defend them in the sense of there was nothing wrong, but to put it in proper context. Soon after Minneapolis meetings in 1888, which Ellen White endorsed, Jones and Wagner began to include elements of false doctrines. Their aberrant theology began with a confusion over the nature of man and sin, which spread into four theological areas, and they point this out. There, Jones preached sermons, these camp meeting sermons, and I told someone earlier, this summer earlier, I did three presentations on camp meetings and revival meetings, and to me that's the most enjoyable thing. This part, I think we need it, but it's more depressing to me. It is beautiful what God was orchestrating when he combined the message Luffro was giving on Adventist history, 1844, and the movement to begin with, along with the fresh message of righteousness by faith, going around to the camp meetings. It was astonishing what was happening. People's lives were being changed by this message. But unfortunately, it was still identified as fanaticism, and eventually, I think, that won its way. Along with the health message. Yeah, I mean, it's all caught up in there. Now, 1889, Jones was preaching at one of these camp meetings. Ellen White is there, endorsing the message. There are stenographers there taking notes of the message. They are teaching a class on stenography. So you had a half dozen or more people taking notes of his message. It's printed in the local paper. One of Jones's 1 hour at least sermons is five paragraphs. Mm-hmm. And people quote from that sermon as determinative proof that by that camp meeting he was already imbibing these false doctrines. How can that be evident? How is it evidence when you quote half his sentence and put ellipses and then the other half of his sentence and disregard the whole context of his sermon and then claim that he was teaching one of these areas of error? Denial of original sin, teaching that Christ took a fallen sinful nature, that justification and sanctification make up righteousness by faith, which also makes a person righteous, that is hit on so specifically. And I would just mention, you know, after the Palmdale Conference, of which Bert Holowiak was attended, when he went back to GC Archives, he wrote several papers that follow this Desmond Ford idea very closely. And he, I believe, is the originator, but has promoted these concepts, which then went to Knight and others on these areas here. All the above led to the teaching of perfectionism and end-time generation concept. So again, this is just summary. Also, Jones especially imbibed the concept of verbal inspiration by attributing inspiration authority to Ellen White. This is interesting to me. I've just been digging into this, but the concept that Barnhouse and Martin originated with the issue over Ellen White that went down to Ford and so forth is being echoed then. And Jones, again, is to blame for supposedly the confusion on this. Because he believed Ellen White had authority in her writings, that's deemed verbal inspiration. But you can believe in Ellen White's authoritative writings without believing she was verbally inspired. And I have not found any specific statement, he says, where Jones states that Ellen White was verbally inspired. I don't think he believed that. He gave how many sermons at the 97 conference on the Spirit of Prophecy?
He talked about it in the first couple of sermons.
Like three or four sermons. Yeah. 1908, Ellen White, when he's rejecting the Spirit of Prophecy, Ellen White refers him back to his own sermons on the Spirit of Prophecy and says new members and you would be benefited by reading these sermons, which are of the Holy Spirit's framing. And yet today, Jones is the lightning rod for accusations about issues over inspiration of Ellen White. One more thing is he's criticized for the idea that Ellen White was a commentary. I have no statement where he specifically says that. Now, I agree that Ellen White is not a commentary on the Bible in the strictest sense, but it's interesting to me that we in our own church have commentaries, which scholars add to, and in the back cover you can read, George Knight included, all these praising reports about how you can understand the Bible better through this commentary because of these scholars' knowledge. But God help us if Ellen White was a commentary to the Bible. I mean, you know...
The whole conflict series is really a
It is, yeah. So now I don't, you know, so we don't need to promote it necessarily, but I'm just saying this is what happens when we throw out these quick, you know, derogatory comments about Jones and his, you know, Ellen White was the commentary of the Bible, you know, haha. Well, wait a minute. Let's think through that. What about your commentary on the shelf? What is that saying?
So what you're saying here is that this is not just about the credibility of Jones and Wagner. This is about the credibility of Ellen White.
Right? It is.
And it's about the credibility of its Adventist identity.
Yes.
Yes.
And I'll tell you, the next generation, the One Project generation, is the generation that can stand up with a bowl of puzzle pieces, university pastor, hold up one puzzle piece out of 3,000 and say, this represents Adventism in his anti-remnant sermon. Now, I tell you, there's a difference, and this is the problem, though, again, a generation that grows up in a church that's not willing to repent for the past becomes cynical towards the remnant idea because they don't see it lived out. Thank you. So see, again, the pendulum, this is the problem. So I would be careful to condemn this university young person for doing that, even though I believe that's absolutely wrong, knowing the fact that if he grew up going through classes that we teach on Adventist history, not all, thankfully, because he held up the book Question on Doctrine, too, and said this is the best thing that ever happened to us as a people. You know, so, and this is what young people today are being told, and if they don't know our roots, incredible. Gillespie's father, I guess, and of course this is, I did not hear it, but in one of his surveys in regard to Adventist young people and their belief in the sanctuary, the number is astoundingly, it's just almost... Yeah. It's terribly low. But we've produced that. We've created that. Number eight here, the four main heresies mentioned above are seen as early as the 1889 camp meetings and Jones and Wagner's teaching. The heresies from Jones resulted, notice this, they created the Holy Flesh movement, and for Wagner, it resulted in pantheism. So now, here's how you keep building on this. These fundamental errors of Jones and Wagner were passed on through the church to A.G. Janels and to M.L. Andreasen, bringing the church to the crisis in 1950. Questions on Doctrines helped free Adventism from these four main heresies and the misuse of Ellen White. And then the clincher. The resurrections of these teachings of Jones and Wagner, including their four main theological heresies, ultimately constitute the Omega apostasy.
So you guys are the Omega.
Yes. There's Desmond Ford wrote the paper, The Doctrinal Decline of Dr. E.J. Wagner, Its Relationship to the Omega Apostasy, and that was his conclusion.
There are two Omegas. The best one is Jesus Christ.
Right. Yeah.
Amen.
So the conclusion here of all conclusions, since my time is up, I don't have time to go anywhere beyond my introduction. But it's really at this point, and I won't be the one that does it, but, you know, all the scholars and all you guys studying and all of us, it's only after we understand all of this history and these rivers of thought, I believe that we're able to prayerfully consider how to rightly apply Ellen White's remarks to 1888, what to do with Ellen White's endorsements of Jones and Wagner, and truly be historically accurate, which were the three talks I was supposed to give, but I don't have time to. But now, I think, maybe in this context, we have a better ability to look at all of these three areas of disagreement and to prayerfully come to a better understanding without going again to another extreme.
Unfortunately, at the primacy of the Gospel Committee, we had all these streams in the room and nobody recognized it.
Yeah.
Can I mention one more extreme?
Yeah.
Yeah, to counterbalance this fourth thing, the forensic only justification that was before Ford and so on, it's from evangelicalism, flowing back to the Council of Concord, I think, after the Reformation, well, during the Reformation period after Luther. But you know, as a counter reaction to that is this moral influence stream, which is being so pushed, and it's just... When it gets hold of somebody, I've seen this including my students,
yeah.
they cannot understand
yeah.
the sanctuary and all those dynamics.
Yeah.
I had one person who had bought into this, just sitting, a very intelligent person, a medical doctor,
mm-hmm.
sitting in the back of my class, just shaking her head.
Yeah.
Just couldn't get it.
Yeah.
Couldn't do well. Didn't do well in the class.
Yeah.
Couldn't get it. It was just out of the
yeah.
box. And this extreme is also totally inimical to antagonistic to this pre-evident judgment in 1844,
yeah.
which deals with, guess what, legal matters.
Yes.
Legal, not legalistic, but
right.
legal in terms of
yeah.
relationship. And if there's nothing legal about the atonement, then that throws that whole thing
yeah.
out. There's no reason for it. It doesn't make sense. So these are two ditches, two extremes on either side,
yeah.
both of which destroy
yeah.
the central Adventist teaching.
Yeah, and I tell you, I think, and I've even sensed this in my own study, reading through all this stuff, there's times in which I say, you know what? What does all this even matter? But yet it does matter. It's important. But I'll tell you, I do think that many in Adventism day, they just, you know what? Who cares about all this theological discussion? I just want an experience. And they're broad open then, absolutely wide open, ready for what evangelical has to bring them. And that's, and I mean, that's what this fourth generation now is dealing with. If it feels good, if it sounds good, it doesn't matter. There's no, and I mean, really, God help us.
Ellen White, though, speaks about the experience in early writings, 55, pages 54, 55, mm-hmm. 56, little section on the end of the 2300 days.
Right.
She nails it. She puts it all together. Because there, you have this little praying company goes with
yes.
Christ by faith into the Holy Vault. You know the passage.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And then Christ breathes on them a holy influence
mm-hmm.
in
yeah.
which the Spirit
love.
Not light and power,
yeah.
but also love, joy, peace. The
yep.
The fruits of the Spirit.
Yep.
And then the group who don't go with him
yeah.
in there reject that.
Yep.
Satan breathes on them an unholy influence
yeah.
in which there's light and power. So we've got this false gospel,
yep.
but not the love, joy, peace. So
yeah.
what is the litmus test? What's the symptom of our being in touch with Jesus where he is now? It's love, joy, peace. And love is the message of the latter rain because love is given by the Spirit, Romans 5,
yeah.
verse 5. That's the power of
yeah.
the Spirit. And the three angels' messages, verse 12 of Revelation 14, here they that keep the commandments of the Lord, commandments based on love. And the faithfulness of Jesus, that's love. And the Elijah message, relational reconciliation, it's all love. And Ella White nailed that connection,
yeah.
which somehow we've got to unpack that, put it together. And not only that, but not only the theory,
yes.
but then
yeah.
live it.
Amen.
Yeah.